Welcome to SILRAP Podcasts. You are about to listen to a service of the Center for International Law Research and Policy.
Thank you, Morten, for the invitation. Thank you also for putting me second last in a panel of six panelists after lunch talking about Kant. This is always popular, and I can imagine you're getting tired of all this, but in order to comfort you, Kant didn't like you either. And in order to prove that, I have made a little handout, and I hope every one of you has this handout. This is not showing off or something, but I have realized that it wouldn't make any sense to put all the quotes of Kant on a PowerPoint presentation, especially since the quotes work together. So the handout is first an alibi for myself in order the presentation is bad, because I think the handout is quite good and you can take it home. But second, it works like this. I'm going to explain my argument and only refer to the numbers next to the quotes, so that I save myself some time and don't have to say, well, see quote on that page or that page, especially since there are many quotes of many pages. But please look at the first quote. What I just said, Kant doesn't like you either. I'm obviously referring to something which has already been said. Namely, he said for Hugo Grotius, Pufendorf, Vatel, and the rest, and then he says something like, sorry comforters, as they are still dutifully quoted in justification of military aggression. This quote is rather sarcastic. By the way, there is one German here to translate sorry comforters, and the original is leidige Tröster, is actually not a very good translation. I didn't find a better translation. I also put some books at the beginning of this handout so you can see what I find the best translations, because it's almost impossible to find really good translations of the German original. But what does that mean? Well, Kant first is obviously not very fond of the named people. Second, Kant denies the relevance of scholars and teachers of international law, at least the outcome of something we are doing here right now. And third, Kant questions the international law, according to Grotius, Pufendorf, and Vatel, because this international law, as envisaged by them, cannot really be enforced. This is his problem. These are just words. Which means, and this is one of my main points I have to get around, that something as the International Criminal Court, according to Kant, cannot really exist, or can it? Well, this is the question. I have already put Article 38 of the ICJ statute on the handout, where you can see that the teachings of the most highly qualified publicists of the various nations, so you, are obviously important for the International Court of Justice. So this is already an indication that Kant might be wrong. What I'm going to do now is I try to justify, you see that on the title, whether an International Criminal Court can exist and whether the International Criminal Court as it is existing right now is actually something Kant would have wanted. The problem with that is that this question already, so the International Criminal Court as it is now, is that something Kant would have wanted, already takes ages to explain. So I'm going to focus more on the argument building up to this. So is there an institutional justification for the International Criminal Court according to Kant? And how do we get there? So can the international criminal community, can they punish? And what is punishment in general? Addressing the first point, I have to quickly talk about what are human rights violations in the nation state. This I can talk about this ages, I make this very quickly. As you can see in quotes 2 and 3, Kant has the idea of human dignity as a source of fundamental human or civil rights, which must be enforced by criminal law. Dignity here is intrinsic, deontological, and non-negotiable. And this is important, it is the basis of the individuality and the mutual recognition, interpersonal relationship, as we could say it, of the members of a society. With regard to punishment, the two quotes I have put in there basically one quote, is telling enough, and this is quote four, if a certain use of freedom is itself a hindrance to freedom in accordance with universal laws, a wrong coercion that is opposed to this as a hindrance, blah, 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 is consistent with freedom in according with universal laws. That is, and this is important again, it is right. Right is a central component in Kant's philosophy. Hence, and this last sentence is actually the sentence we have to get around in order to justify the International Criminal Court, hence, there is connected with right by the principle of contradiction an authorization to coerce someone who infringes upon it, which means the state can coerce, but no one else. What about the human rights violations and criminal law on the international level? Kant's conception of human dignity is complemented by his vision of an eternal peace, peace that can never be reached, but his work is towards an eternal peace. I have put down the structure of the eternal peace on the handout. It has three preliminary articles that ban treacherous dealings among states. And to be eternal, that means to be permanent and sustainable, such a peace presupposes the fulfillment of three conditions, of three definitive articles. They are interrelated, but still distinct. They are distinct levels of right in the juridical sense of the term, which is becoming important in a moment. First, most importantly, that the states have a republican constitution, and here the first time the word constitution is mentioned, constitution guaranteeing the liberty and equality of their citizens as inalienable rights. Second, is the fear of rightful relations among the nations resulting from treaty obligations among states, the Völkerrecht. And third, a world citizen law, which entails the right of hospitality. That means that each citizen must not be treated in a hostile way by another state. Hospitality sounds a little bit odd, and Kant admits that. He admits the oddity of the context and remarks that it is not a question of philanthropy, but really only a question of right. From this, a two-step argument follows for my purposes here. First, a just and permanent peace is predicated on the recognition and respect for the rights of the citizens. That means, in modern language, of human rights. And second, violations of these rights have to be stigmatized as serious wrongs and have to be punished. In sum, with this conception, Kant laid the foundations for all current conceptions of human dignity and world peace. Now, what about the protection of this human rights, of these human rights violations? Following Kant, a series of other, particularly German scholars, have argued that the state and the international community is called upon to protect this human dignity. But why? There is first a very convincing argument made by German scholar Katrin Gierhake, who considers that international punishment compensates on the individual level, remember this interpersonal relationship, for the material injustice brought about by an international crime with regard to this interpersonal relationship of citizens. So this has nothing to do with cosmopolitan right and so on. And second, other scholars employ a more cosmopolitan view, which is probably the majority view and vision, which can also be traced back to a Kantian idea of Weltbürgerrecht, and to this concept, human dignity focusing on people instead of states as subjects of international order. So human dignity is here also understood as the moral source of subjective rights of all people, of universally recognized human rights. Now, I want you to read quote 9, because this is the central quote why human rights violations actually are fought for the entire international community. Kant says, violation or speaks of violations of rights that are felt throughout the world. This is one translation. The other translation, which is a little bit more convincing, would be everywhere. So imagine there's a human rights violation going on right now, somewhere in the world. Kant says, you feel it right now, if it's serious. We all feel it right now. So I was puzzled by that. You can imagine there are about 1,000 theories why we feel it right now. And all these theories seem to, not all these theories, but most of them seem to be little convincing when I ask myself, why would I feel a human rights violation right now somewhere in the world? Now, there are several attempts to answer this question. Merkel, a German scholar, for instance, opines that felt means much more than just following or noting this human rights violation. It is the symbolic harm of the validity of a Grundnorm, and you hear Kelsen renouncing. Or David Luben claims, with regard to crimes against humanity, that the assault on the core of humanity that we all share and that distinguishes us from other human beings, on the individuality and sociability of the victims in tandem, converts the paid perpetrator into an enemy of humanity. Now, I find all these things not really convincing with regard to the word of felt. And compared to all the complicated terminology Kant deliberately uses throughout his works, felt does not sound so complicated, in my view. Why would he use such an uncomplicated language, especially since he used his complicated language deliberately because of the official a priori character of Kant's critique of judgment, where he actually said that a priori knowledge is knowledge that is absolutely independent of all experience, and experience includes language. He had to use complicated language, but now he uses felt. I have put down some quotes where actually Kant addresses felt in several other contexts. These are the quotes 10 and 11. And here you can see that Kant juxtaposes felt with think. What I think what most scholars do is they actually use this interchangeably. Felt is think, which seems not really logical reading Kant. So feeling must be something more. And especially since Kant justifies this feeling by a social justification, not a metaphysical justification. So what is this feeling? And I go here with Habermas,
who created some kind or suggested some kind of public sphere we have, where community, where communication is something incredibly important. Communication, the public, is the collective body of all citizens, and please read quote 13:14, which is the world at large containing a viewpoint of everyone else. So for Kant, not only free speech, by the way, but also communication and the public sphere was absolutely vital, world public opinion. A public opinion, a platform where people could share their views, share their likes and dislikes. And obviously, the media played an incredibly big role in that. And if we transfer that to today, what greater public sphere could we have with social media and so on? So actually, it is probably not what Merkel says, more than just noting and seeing on TV when a human rights violation occurs, but this is exactly the point, that we feel it because we note it, because community and public sphere allows us actually to see what's going on in the world, and allows me, when I'm later on going on Twitter and see what happened in a certain region of the world, to feel a very serious human rights violation. But also, we're getting now to the International Criminal Court, but also the public sphere can be quite dangerous, because the public sphere can be the foundation for human rights fundamentalism, for using human rights actually to commit crimes and actually to go to war, something Carl Schmitt criticized. Now, what's the institutional justification then for the ICC? As I said, the international community has the power to punish. I can go into that further in the question, but not now. But what is the justification for this institution? First, please read quotes 15 to 17. Kant actually found court forums quite important. Right was not enough. He says the moral person that administers justice is a court forum, and its administration of justice is a judgment. So for Kant, obviously the International Criminal Court as a court is thinkable. But what about this court who can punish? Now, as I already said, and please read again quote 3 at the end, some may rightly point out that Kant did not advocate an international criminal court because something outside of a state cannot have the coercive right. There's a counter-argument to that. It's more like Kelsen counter-argument, again used by Merkel, who says that it does not much make much sense to search for an answer to this within the understanding of coercion within the nation state, but more a coercion with regard to right. So right may comprise more or less formalized coercion mechanisms, which could be outside of the state realm. And I think this you could even read into Kant if you read the quotes 19 and 20. So Kant actually says that the International Criminal Court is institutionally possible, or he does not say that it's not institutionally possible. Why? Not because of definitive Article 3, the cosmopolitan law, but more of definitive Article 2, Kant's negative substitute. So reshaping political institutions in accordance with that negative substitute, with that definitive Article 2, is the way to go in order to justify the International Criminal Court. And this actually was happening in the Nuremberg trials, the forerunners of the International Criminal Court, which reflect precisely the transition from a Kantian universalism to a more contextualized cosmopolitanism. So to come very quickly to the end, I think the International Criminal Court is institutionally justified, but how it is now, is that what Kant would have envisaged? Well, Kant wanted to have a constitution. Kant uses the word constitution very often, and it's probably a matter of another debate whether this constitution is a constitution how we know it and how we know it in a nation state. But understanding the international community as a community bound together by common social values, there must be an international constitution of some kind. And we have seen in the European Union that a constitution can actually be built up on a very partial constitution. In the European Union, it was the economic constitution. Why not have an international criminal constitution? And it is without doubt, in my view, that the International Criminal Court is such an institution because it codifies human rights in a way no criminal court has done before. Remember Article 21, which says that human rights are an important source of the International Criminal Court. So I think the International Criminal Court, as it is now, is a constitution. We can go into this more detail, and this is a major part of my paper, and Kant would not have minded that. I have 1 minute left, and just as a nice anecdote, because we are rather late, as you can see, some of you tried to shake my hand. I have broken my finger, so I can't use my right hand. In order to prepare this presentation, I had to use a new dictation software. I don't know whether some of you have used dictation software, so I had to dictate everything I said now into my computer. And as you can imagine, very funny sentences have been created. And there's just one sentence that stuck in my head. I actually sometimes copy and paste it into several documents and maybe publish it someday. But I wanted to say, I dictated, Kant is postulating something like cosmopolitan politics. And the sentence came out was, Kant is hot. I don't know why, but maybe that's for another presentation.
Thank you for listening. For more open access audio recordings, films, and publications, go to silrap.org.